And as we continue to navigate these unprecedented times, KCBS is trying to get answers to your questions about the coronavirus pandemic, all aspects of it, from health to law to your lives. Every morning, Monday through Friday at 9:20, we're doing an Ask an Expert segment, and each day we'll focus on a different aspect of the situation. Today, back to medicine with an emergency medicine specialist, Dr. Jahan Fahimi, the director of UCSF Emergency Medicine. He's with us on the KCBS Ring Central Newsline. Doctor, thank you for taking the time this morning, and you know, there's so many questions. You must be bombarded with these in daily life there at UCSF. Do you find that people are having more questions as we're going along, or fewer?
That's a really good question. I think that initially there was a lot of uncertainty and a lot of questions. I think people were in some ways a little bit panicked and were rushing to the ER to get tested, to be evaluated. I think people have calmed down for the most part and realized that the best source of information might just be to kind of watch the news, talk to their doctor, do a little bit of reading online. But showing up to the ER right away with symptoms doesn't seem to be the right answer for most folks. I think people realize that you know, you don't want to unnecessarily show up to the hospital or to a healthcare setting if you don't have to at these times. And so I think people are turning to the news, programs like this, to get some information and kind of get a sense of where things are at and what they should be worried about.
And before we get going, you know, there have been these anecdotal reports from all over the country that emergency rooms have become rather quieter places, fewer traumas, fewer walk-ins. Is that going on from where you sit?
Yes, that's absolutely true. I think there's a couple of things that's driving that. The first is the shelter-in-place orders make it so that people stay home. And, you know, when you stay home, perhaps you're a little less likely to be out and get injured, fewer car accidents as a result of decreased traffic. I think there are people who maybe pre-coronavirus would have thought, oh, you know, I'm having a complaint. Maybe I should go get it checked out right now. Maybe we'll think twice about that and we'll call their doctor or perhaps use something like telemedicine, video visits in order to get these things evaluated. The other part of it, I think, is also that we've been very intentional about trying to keep folks out of the hospital to the extent possible. So fewer surgeries, fewer procedures, trying to get the hospital empty and prepared for a potential surge. And overall, just decreasing the amount of traffic through the hospital is inevitably going to result in decreased visits through the ER.
Okay. Well, let's turn to some of these questions we've gotten from our listeners. They send them in via email, askus@kcbsradio.com. What do you do if you think you're experiencing beginning or minor COVID-19 symptoms?
So I think at the first symptom of something that you are worried about, I would highly recommend trying to check in with your regular doctor. If you don't have a regular doctor, there are lots of urgent care options around the Bay Area, many of whom will now offer video visits. That would be the first place to start, in my opinion. It is also allergy season, and I know that many people have confused their symptoms. You know, something they would have just attributed to allergies a year ago now cause a little bit of anxiety because it's hard to know. So I think that's why it's important to just kind of get it, you know, vetted by a healthcare professional. Again, by no means should you rush to the hospital if you think you might have early COVID-19 symptoms if you're not having severe symptoms. You know, if it's a scratch in the throat, a dry cough, maybe even like a low-grade fever, these are perfect symptoms to bring up with a doctor by telephone, by video visit. And if it's decided that you need to get testing, then you can be referred into a place to get a test performed.
Okay, next question. Does anything we do at home to treat symptoms prevent the escalation and, of course, the scenario nobody wants to see, an ICU visit, an intubation, that sort of thing?
Right. So I think in terms of once somebody has the infection, I'm not aware of any sort of home remedy or best practices at home to try and prevent the progression of that illness. I think if you have been diagnosed with COVID-19, All the more reason for you to be in touch with your physician, to be following your symptoms closely at home, probably, you know, every day or every other day, be checking in to kind of see how things are going. And for any worsening of symptoms, you may need to be referred into the hospital. But for those who haven't been diagnosed, I mean, the number one thing that you can do is stay at home to the extent possible. If you do have to go out, wearing a face covering is good practice, a mask if you have it, and lots and lots of hand washing.
Okay, let's talk about fever. There are a couple of different questions. I'll see if I can merge these here. Is a high fever emblematic of COVID-19? Is any fever, are there people who have COVID-19 but don't have a fever?
Yes. So what we know is that about half of folks who present with COVID-19 to the hospital won't have a fever at the time of arrival. Now, most will eventually at some point go on to develop a fever, but the absence of a fever does not rule out COVID-19. Now, that being said, the degree of fever or the pattern of the fever, I don't think that these are predictive of COVID-19 infection. So, you know, I think if someone has a fever without an obvious other explanation for that fever, then that's certainly something that we would want to take seriously. Again, checking in with your doctor, getting in to see somebody. But I don't think that necessarily a high fever or a low-grade fever necessarily helps me differentiate between who might have it and who might not.
Okay, and another question had to do with managing a fever. So if you have one, are there things you definitely shouldn't or definitely should be taking in terms of over-the-counter or home remedies?
Sure. The number one thing is to stay very well hydrated. Plenty of fluids, plenty of water. Tylenol is, or acetaminophen is considered to be probably the safest medication you can take to decrease the fever and make you feel a little bit better. Ibuprofen, or, you know, medications like Advil or Motrin, those can also be taken. However, there's a little bit of controversy about whether or not that medication in particular might interact with the virus. That being said, you know, one dose or two doses, I don't think is a particular concern. I think if somebody has been diagnosed with COVID-19 and they can manage their symptoms with just taking acetaminophen or Tylenol, that would be preferable. But I think, you know, taking a dose of ibuprofen now and again is probably not going to hurt things either if that's what's necessary to manage the fever.
Let's talk about cough. Here's a question. Does the cold or the cough go from dry to wet with pneumonia? Does it stay dry and turn into pneumonia?
It's a good question. As with the fever, you know, it's not like there's one particular brand of cough that is emblematic of the coronavirus infection. So, you know, I think that people, the classic description has been the dry cough as a presenting symptom. And certainly this can turn into, you know, a more of a productive or wet cough. But I don't think that that is any criteria that any of us use to decide whether or not somebody has a COVID-19 infection. I think if somebody has a cough, and certainly a cough with fever or with other symptoms, the chest x-ray is what helps us a lot. We'll be able to see if there's early signs of pneumonia on the x-ray. And, you know, if we see that, that definitely triggers us to want to get a test for the COVID-19 infection.
Let me just, because I've got another cough question here, but that test now in the clinical environment, how fast do you get the results back now if somebody is being tested at the hospital?
Yeah, if somebody's being tested at our hospital, we sort of have two speeds at which we can do the test, and this is probably true for many places. The fast turnaround time is usually on the order of hours. So some facilities will be able to do it in as fast as, you know, 2 to 3 hours. In some cases, it might take as long as 8 to 12 hours to get that turnaround time. And, you know, many listeners may have heard about these very, very rapid 15-minute tests that can be done. And those do exist. We at UCSF are currently evaluating them. The thing to keep in mind is that no test is perfect. And so just because you take a test and it comes back negative does not necessarily guarantee that there's no infection. And some of these faster turnaround time tests, we worry, are less accurate than the ones that might take a little bit longer. So the ones that take a few hours, we think, are more accurate than the ones that may provide results in a matter of minutes. So that's just an important caveat to know as people talk about these sort of rapid tests, or at some point people have been talking about doing home tests. We need to validate that these are accurate before we start allowing people to take them. The second speed of test, there's a longer version of the test, which takes a few days to come back. And the reason for that is because we only have a certain amount of capacity for testing inside our laboratories. So once we exceed that, we then have to send the samples to outside laboratories, and so it'll take a little bit longer for those test results to come back. And the way we determine who gets a rapid test versus who gets a test that might take, you know, a day or two to return, it sort of depends on the risk. So if somebody's being hospitalized, we want to know the answer right away. If somebody's a healthcare worker, we definitely need to know the answer right away. Certainly, if somebody lives in a, you know, in a household with lots and lots of other members who are potentially at risk, somebody who's immunocompromised, those are people that we need to know the test results right away, and we'll try to get those within a few hours.
Okay, back to the cough. Should you take over-the-counter cough medicine? Does it prevent progression to pneumonia?
No. In this scenario, any of the home remedies, over-the-counter medications, just to suppress the cough, are not going to actually change the disease course for the COVID-19 infection. If it's going to progress onto a more severe pneumonia, then it's going to progress onto a more severe pneumonia.
A lot of people over the years have been told to take a look at the color of their phlegm. And this question says, is it typically clear? Should you look for some color? How do you deal with that?
Yeah, the color of phlegm traditionally has not been a very good predictor of whether somebody has just a little bronchitis or a viral infection versus a bacterial pneumonia. Certainly, as disease becomes more and more severe, we may tend to see a cloudier phlegm, occasionally streaks of blood in the phlegm. These are not atypical findings from more severe disease. But just because somebody has clear phlegm does not exclude a COVID-19 infection, certainly early on in the course.
A lot of people, there's a question here about what level of difficulty breathing is a matter of concern. People who've had asthma or COPD may have one feeling about that. Those who haven't may not know that. So is there a good way of putting in words what compromised breathing or difficulty breathing feels like, a test you can give yourself, something like that?
Yes. I think my advice would generally be that if somebody gets up to walk around their own home and feels pretty significantly winded by doing an activity that would have otherwise been very, very easy, they wouldn't have even thought twice about it. So walking around the home, sometimes even having a prolonged conversation, if just talking vigorously for a minute or two causes someone to feel winded, these might be concerning symptoms, and that might be something that I would recommend in-person evaluation for.
People are asking, there are a few questions here about what I should have on hand. So any recommendations regarding thermometers, these pulse oximeters, you know, that measure oxygen in your blood, are those useful?
Well, I think the pulse oximeter could be of value in somebody who is diagnosed with COVID-19. But if you otherwise don't have symptoms, then I think that there's very little utility in having that. Quite honestly, that's the kind of thing where, you know, you're just going to be looking at a number in isolation. What is the oxygen saturation? That doesn't provide me with very much information. But if somebody has been diagnosed with COVID-19 and has, you know, mild to moderate symptoms, at the discretion of their physician, you know, you may want to have a pulse oximeter if you can get one. Just to kind of track the progression of the oxygen saturation in the blood. So I think that that's, could have some use, although not routinely. A good thermometer is a great thing to have. I know they're very hard to find these days.
They sure are.
Sold out. But, you know, what I would say is there, you know, everyone should have a thermometer and should know how to use it. Just for, you know, listeners' reference, in the healthcare realm, we consider 100.4 to be a fever. So below that, you know, if somebody has a temperature of 99.9, we don't consider that a fever. It may be that if we check again in an hour, it's going to go higher. But I notice frequently that patients will start to feel worried when the temperature hits 99 point something. And I just want to reassure people that those low-grade temperatures are something to keep an eye on, but not necessarily to particularly worry or panic about.
Okay. These next couple may be a little outside your bailiwick, and if so, just tell us. You can't answer them. Two people asked about ivermectin. This is, I believe, an antiparasitic. It's used in both dogs and humans. I actually went and looked up some papers on it. It's been FDA approved for those purposes. The question was, what's the process for repurposing such drugs to use them? I guess you'd call it off-label for something new.
Right. There's a lot of interest right now in off-label use of a lot of different medications to test for COVID-19. Studies need to be done before we can make any recommendations about these drugs. And so I don't know of any data that suggests that ivermectin has any efficacy in treating COVID-19. Doesn't mean that there aren't studies being done, and it doesn't mean that if those studies were positive, that they wouldn't subsequently get FDA approval. But that process takes some time. Doing high-quality research in order to get at the truth as to whether or not a medication works, you know, going beyond anecdotal evidence, takes time if you want to do it right.
Okay. This listener wants to know if you know what percentage of people who wind up on a ventilator during COVID-19 actually survive.
I think that number is highly variable. In a place where that is completely overwhelmed by the number of cases coming in through into the hospital, that number is going to be lower. When you have a workforce and a health system that's completely stressed, that can't provide really intensive monitoring to patients who are having severe COVID infections, the mortality goes up and the likelihood of being taken off of a ventilator goes down. In facilities, and this is the case currently in San Francisco and at our hospital at UCSF, patients that get put on a ventilator, we're having pretty decent success in getting them off of the ventilator. And it's because we are paying very, very close attention to every single COVID-19 infection in the ICU. And we have the manpower and the bandwidth to be very, very mindful and attuned to each individual patient. In speaking to colleagues in New York, they don't have that luxury. When the system is completely overwhelmed, patients don't get the same level of scrutiny and moment-to-moment monitoring that we can provide here right now. And this just completely underscores the importance of social distancing. It underscores the importance that we slow down the spread of this infection so that when people do get it and they come to the hospital, we are not overwhelmed. We have the luxury of time and preparation to take care of everybody very, very carefully. So the number, the percentage there is going to highly vary depending on the total overall number of cases. Okay. Generally speaking, people have been floating this number of about, 50% of people will get off of a ventilator. But again, that number remains to be seen after we've had a little bit more data.
Okay. This one, and we've got one more for you after this, and we'll let you go. My 22-year-old niece has been sheltering in place with a friend in Chicago after going there a month ago for a now-canceled project. A lot of people got caught out like this. She needs to be home for some medical diagnostic tests in May. We're weighing the risk of virus exposure in transit to postponing those tests. She's been careful about any essential outside activity, but at least gets out to walk the dog. If she comes home anytime soon, would she need to be quarantined for 2 weeks? And if so, suggestions from the medical field?
This is a tough question. You know, I think that if you're in a place like Chicago where there's more transmission of the COVID-19 infection than there is here in the Bay Area, you need to be careful. Now, if somebody has really truly been isolated and sheltering in place, any person that they've come into contact with has also been appropriately isolating themselves, then perhaps they're out of the window. And you could say, you know, you've successfully have observed yourself through this process, and you are at very low risk, and so maybe you're in the clear. Now, the traveling part is going to pose another wrinkle here. So you get on a plane and you fly here, and I assume that the question is, does that person then need to quarantine for 2 weeks?
Yeah.
I can't necessarily provide strict guidance. I think that when somebody does travel, whether they travel or not, you know, they should be isolating to the extent possible. Certainly, if I were to get on a plane and fly someplace right now, if I had to, I would be extra mindful about watching my symptoms for a couple of weeks, just to kind of see if I picked up anything during that period of travel. I would absolutely wear a mask and probably gloves and bring some sanitary wipes and wipe down my surfaces on the airplane. I would absolutely not touch my face to the extent possible and do lots of hand washing.
Okay. This last one, and really this questioner says, look, I don't want to overwhelm the system, but I want to be safe. At what point do I call the doctor? At what point do I go to the ER?
Yes. So I think that if you have access to a doctor, to an urgent care, if you have concerns, if you have fever, cough, unexplained body aches, new or severe headaches, those kinds of things, certainly we're now realizing loss of taste and smell. For some people, loss of appetite or GI distress might be a presenting symptom. If you're developing any of those symptoms, I think it's reasonable to call your doctor, get on a video visit, check in at an urgent care online. And get an initial evaluation and see if you need to be tested. The people that I want to see in my ER are people who are having trouble breathing or having more severe versions of those same illnesses that can't be managed by a doctor as an outpatient and can't be managed at home. I want to see people who are having difficulty breathing. Certainly, if anybody is having bluish lips, feeling faint, like they might pass out, those are things that I'm a little bit concerned about, and I'd like to see those patients.
Well, we hope you don't see too many. We do thank you very much for the time you spent with us this morning. I know it's valuable right now. Thanks.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. That's Dr. Jahan Fahimi. He's the director of emergency medicine at UC San Francisco.